The notion that you are what you eat appeared in France about 200 years ago, and it turned up in the English-speaking world a lot more recently, in the 1920s and 30s. If we are what we eat, perhaps we can understand ourselves a little better if we understand choices we do make or don't make about food. Brown University neuroscientist Rachel Herz examines the science behind our eating habits in her new book, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. It's published by Norton, and I'm very pleased it brings Professor Herz to our show. Hi.
Hi, Arun. How are you?
Great. Thank you. So, is it true that human beings actually have the most sophisticated sense of taste of all species?
Not sense of taste, sense of flavor. Because flavor is actually what most people refer to as taste. It has to do with how our sense of smell is involved in what we consume. And we have the most advanced flavor system in terms of how our nose works with our mouth to give us the experience of bacon, for instance, as opposed to just salt.
Bacon. So, how did this happen? This is sort of an evolutionary, I guess, quirk that you describe in your book about the trade-off between having this, about talking, the ability to speak, and how that resulted in an improved sense of flavor, as you say.
Well, so humans can speak, and it seems that we have the only capacity to do so of any other species on the planet, dolphins notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. But that has to do with the fact that we can make these complex sounds has to do with having an open airway passage between our lungs and our throat and our nose and our mouth. And the trade-off for having an open airway passage between your nose and your mouth means that what you consume and what your volatile molecules are in your mouth goes into your nose, and also what goes into your nose is perceived at the same time that you're chewing something. Mm-hmm. So in particular, the latter, or rather the former, I should say, of having what we're chewing in our mouth, the volatiles from that, going up into our nasal passages and influencing our olfactory receptors while we are tasting, and tasting only being the pure experiences of salt, sour, sweet, and bitter, makes our experience of food so incredibly rich and our perception of flavor unique.
And so this is unusual. Most species don't appreciate things to the same extent that we do.
No, not at all. So even, for instance, a dog who has a phenomenal sense of smell, they do not perceive flavor the way we do because their airway passage is closed off from their nose to their mouth. Now, the sort of negative side of having this open airway passage means that we can choke while we're eating. Mm-hmm. Because if we're talking and or breathing in the wrong way while we're consuming, then food that is going into our mouth, down our throat, can also end up in our lungs, and that can have very deleterious consequences. So that's sort of the negative side of being able to speak and eat and experience flavor.
But then we take food, I guess, to a much, I guess, another level altogether by the ability to alter it, which is also, I guess, unusual in the animal kingdom. Am I right?
So you mean like cooking, for instance?
Yeah.
Right. So humans are sometimes referred to as sort of the cooking species as something that distinguishes us from other animals. But I think that the invention of our ability to use and harness fire and do all sorts of other kinds of preparations with food does make us different. And also, I think maybe what really makes us the most different is how much we appreciate that and how much we are interested in exploring that constantly.
And so there's an actual evolutionary advantage to being able to alter or cook, am I right?
Well, yes. So cooking food actually makes it easier to digest, and the calories and the macronutrients in the food easier to incorporate into your body. So for instance, eating a raw food diet is in fact not all that healthy if you want to really get all the nutrients from your food. And so from a point of view of the fact that, you know, calories are scarce, not necessarily in today's Western culture, but if we're worried about actually maintaining as much nutrition from the foods we're eating as possible, you actually want to eat it cooked. So cooking does have definitely that evolutionary advantage of helping us survive in a nutrition sort of scarce world, as it were.
So you begin the book with a discussion of taste, what taste is. Is taste the key to understanding why we eat what we do or don't eat some things?
Well, it's the beginning. So I sort of want to start with the most obvious sensory dimension to our experience of food, and especially because, as you even said, most people think everything that goes into our mouth is taste when really the majority of it is flavor. So I talk about taste and I talk about smell, but the tastes are definitely the scaffolding upon which all our relationship with food is built upon, because if you couldn't taste, then that would sort of, you know, stop the story there. And that's why I think it's really important to bring up. But I also think it's important because not only do the tastes tell us about the food we're consuming, they also tell us a lot about ourselves. And they can influence our moods and our feelings. So, for instance, tasting sweetness actually makes people nicer. And the ability to taste bitter is related to differences in genetics, but also can influence our moral judgments. And so these things don't just have their basic rule and relationship to eating. They actually influence our social discourse.
And so the fact that I have a sweet tooth actually suggests that I'm a pretty great guy.
Yes,
am I right?
Yeah.
That's what you say, that there's actual correlation between people who have sweet tooths and their temperament?
Well, yes, generally, but also people think you're nicer. That could help too. So people, when they hear about people that like a lot of sweets, they think that they're nicer than people who don't eat a lot of sweets or who have preferences for other types of foods. Mm-hmm. But yes, generally, it has been shown that people who have a preference for sweets tend to be somewhat kinder than people who want to stay away from them. But anybody, even if you don't really like sweets terribly, if you taste something sweet, you actually get, you know, a little boost of kindness in that particular moment.
And yet, if I have like a Jacques Torres cookie, for the first half I feel really happy and then suddenly I'm really self-loathing. Why is there such a sharp arc in that experience between being very like self-loving and suddenly just hating myself?
Well, that probably has to do with how you feel about having consumed the cookie and the worry that you might have about
myself,
the calories.
Yeah.
And well, that's, you really shouldn't hate yourself, because the message of my book really is love food and love what you eat, but learn how it's influencing you and what is influencing your relationship with it. And then when you have the power to understand that, then you can bring all the food back into your world that you love, but just understand what's going on.
But there's so much information. This is the problem with eating nowadays, is that you're just so overwhelmed by information. How are we supposed to actually make sense of all the conflicting signals we get about food, whether raw is good or whether paleo is good or carbs are bad and all that stuff? I mean, this seems to have a real impact on our psychology of eating these days.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, you can't really keep up with the change in information that health and nutritionists and diet people and doctors are even telling you about what's good or bad. And so rather than focusing on that, I wanted to focus on how our basic sensory relationship with food and how the psychological environment that we're in and our own psychology influences what we eat. Regardless of, you know, one day carbs are terrible, next day sugar is terrible, next day everyone should eat butter, whatever the case might be, rather than worrying about those specifics, why is it that I want to eat sugar? Why is it that I want to eat butter? And is it the case that in the situation that I'm in, something about the situation is making me want to eat that more than in other situations? And even there are people who actually really, really hate food. I talk about that in my book as well. People who have what's called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, who can't bear to consume food, seems strange to most of us. But there's also ways that their psychology and the sensory environment that they live in can be changed to benefit their relationship with food. So it's really about trying to get down to the basics, sort of the sensory and the psychological domains that influence and guide our relationship with food that the book is about.
So given what all you do know about food, do you actually find yourself judging certain people who have certain predispositions or avoid certain things?
I don't think so. I mean, one of the things that's fun.
Not very judgy.
One of the things that was sort of fun to sort of learn about, or as I knew some of this from other research, because I've done some work on moral psychology and the taste of bitter, mm-hmm. is how psychopaths actually are people who really are amoral, don't have any morality, and they're not interested in helping other people at all. And they tend to be people who are not very sensitive to bitter.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of just a correlation between genetics and personality. Who knows what came first? But in any case, it sort of made me chuckle a little bit to think about, well, if I know someone who in the genetic world is called a non-taster, that is to say they're not sensitive to bitter, should I, you know, maybe not be as friendly with them as I might otherwise be? But that's just silly. I mean, you know, that's these little things that actually influence, but they go into the very, very big complex picture, which is so much more than that.
So yeah, you do get into this whole idea that there is supposedly a correlation between bitterness and people who indulge in or have a characteristic known as everyday sadism. Is that right?
Yeah.
What is everyday sadism, and how does food predict our, I guess, likelihood to be everyday sadists?
So that's just one of the traits that's associated with the personality of being a psychopath. And it's just, you know, not minding when nasty things happen to other people, or, you know, potentially stepping on something to hurt somebody a little bit. You know, these sorts of little things. I mean, people who are full-blown psychopaths really don't get any emotional reactivity from the world. And so part of their problem is looking for stimulation that can bring them to some degree of feeling alive. Huh. And unfortunately, a lot of that, because negative is so much more overwhelmingly powerful than positive and just our whole psychological sphere of things, because bad things will kill you and good things, you know, that's nice, but they don't necessarily keep you alive the way bad things can kill you, absolutely. And so looking for things that are highly stimulating, unfortunately, tends to be negative. So that's why psychopaths, rather than, you know, being super, super joyful and fantastic, are really usually nasty and mean and cruel, because that's what they can feel. And so that's where this goes down, you know, that line. But I don't want to get too bogged down by saying that people who can't taste bitter are all psychopaths or anything along those lines. These are studies which are, and it's important to make the point that they're correlations, not causations. So, you know, people who are within the group of being, let's say, non-tasters tend to show more of these particular traits than people who are in the group of being super tasters. But this is not saying that one causes the other or in any way, shape, or form is like a prescription for your mental health or well-being.
So you mentioned how certain foods like capsaicin, how do you pronounce it?
Capsaicin.
Which is what is responsible for spiciness, how it's been weaponized by, I guess, it's certain militaries. Mm-hmm. Is food psychology also like being weaponized, or like is it being developed by our military, for instance, to try to make the most of when it comes to dealing with our enemies or combatants?
So I don't know that capsaicin is being used at all by the U.S. military. It is the example I gave was from the Indian military.
Right.
And so the idea is that capsaicin produces a terrible burn. So things like the ghost pepper, mm-hmm. which is currently, I think, the Guinness Book of World Records strongest pepper in terms of Scoville units, which measures the heat. So it's right. over, it's something like close to 2 million Scoville units. And so something like that, which really, really, really burns. If you threw that in somebody's face, especially if it hit their eyes, that would be absolutely debilitating. So, but you would need to be in close contact with someone to be able to do that. And
or, it's called a chili bomb, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know that the U.S. is experimenting with that. Maybe after hearing this, they will.
Well, let's hope. Yeah, right.
They've also actually tried to practice with developing stink bombs. That is to say, to try to develop, rather than using tear gas to disperse a rioting crowd, of trying to get a smell that would be able to disperse people who are getting out of control. But interestingly, there hasn't been yet developed or found a smell that can clear a stadium the way that tear gas can. And the reason for that, maybe something would work in the United States, but it wouldn't work in another culture. And that's because the way that we respond to smells is through learning and through our associations. So even when the U.S. tried practicing with something called U.S. Army latrine scent, it worked in the U.S., but it didn't work in other cultures, because if you have sewage, which is kind of part of daily life, the smell of U.S. Army latrine is not, maybe not your favorite smell, but it's not going to get you scurrying out of some place like it's, you know, the most horrible thing that's happening.
Right.
Capsaicin, on the other hand, might, because that really hurts.
I'm Arun Vanikopal, and I'm speaking with neuroscientist Rachel Herz about her latest book, You Are What You Eat. So capsaicin, you go into some depth about our relationship with hot and spicy food. And I think you enter stores in Ohio where there's just like a massive, like extraordinary selection of chili sauces. 30 or 40 years ago, this would not have been the case in America, where you could have found that many spicy foods, I guess. Do you see that our tastes as a society are dramatically shifting? And what does that mean?
So I actually think, and I don't really go into this in my book, this is more a personal observation, and mm-hmm. the store I was in was this crazy store called Jungle Jim's, which if anyone is ever in the Cincinnati area, I recommend going to if you like food. It's just like, talk about being in a candy store. it's pretty incredible. And the whole space is just amazing also, just architecturally mm-hmm. and everything that they have in it. But so I think that food TV, in fact, and I'm not really sure, again, sort of chicken and egg, what came first, sort of our foodie nation or food TV kind of creating a foodie nation or the travel network or how this kind of evolved. But things like our love for spicy food, our love for bacon, these sorts of things which we're now obsessed with, I think that media has had a lot to do with. So I don't know that, I mean, media changing the culture changing media, both of them working together. I think right now they're spinning off of each other in a kind of a positive feedback loop. But I think that food TV originally kind of embedded these sort of nouvelle tastes in our mind and has then taken off where people want to go with it. And then that's fed back into the food TV world and mm-hmm. so on and so mm-hmm. forth.
Do you think, though, that it actually, I guess, is drawing upon what is happening elsewhere or in, around the world very effectively in terms of our tastes that are, say, the vanguard in, say, China or in India or in Europe. Are they quickly adopted here? Is it increasingly fast in terms of that timeline?
So I think definitely. So we're a global world these days. And, you know, with a 24-hour news cycle, everything is constantly available. You look online, you can see what's happening in India just as much as you can see what's happening on Fifth Avenue. So I think that as a function of that and always sort of seeking new change, we want something different. And especially I think the TV shows want to sort of present new things because you can't just keep talking about apple pie because, you know, you may have the greatest apple pie, but that gets dull. So we need to bring in something interesting. And so I think that's where the culture of other food cuisines comes in and how developing new tastes, but even tastes that we're familiar with, like bacon, or I should say the flavor of bacon, which has become such an obsession, I think that has to do with sort of the moment and why everybody wants to be involved with it right now.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, and I'm speaking with the neuroscientist Rachel Herz about her latest book, You Are What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. Later on in the show, James and Carla Murray, who have been photographing New York City since the 1990s with their new book, Storefront 2, A History Preserved. And Paulina Poboja and Kara Maines, curators at the Museum of Modern Art, discuss the MoMA's new exhibition focusing exclusively on works made by artists in their mid to late careers. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and I'm speaking with neuroscientist Rachel Herz about her latest book, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. Rachel, one thing I didn't know until I read your book was that we actually have taste receptors throughout our body, not simply in our mouths. Why is that?
So taste receptors are really just chemical receptors. And so they're a certain kind of chemical receptor that is responsive to things that are salty, sour, sweet, and bitter. But they're also responsive to all kinds of other chemicals. And so they can be various places in our body, as you noted. And what's most interesting in some ways is how we have these taste receptors in our gut. So not only is our mouth tasting what we eat, but our intestines and our stomach is also tasting what we eat to a certain extent. And that can actually influence how we like foods and what we like to eat, because the taste receptors in our gut are actually responding to what's called the post-ingestive quality of the food. So not the immediate sensory, oh, that's sweet, but actually what's going on after I swallow that and how that interacts with my body and so on. And sometimes if something feels really good to eat for your body, that makes the taste of it even better. So for instance, if you were craving protein and you had been sort of starved of protein, then not only would a protein food taste good on your tongue, but actually your stomach and your body would really respond positively to it, which would feed back onto the taste and make you like that taste more. And that's actually the story of umami.
Mm-hmm. Which is a relatively recent idea, isn't it, compared to many other tastes that we describe?
Exactly. So in my book, I actually don't put umami in with the other tastes. I consider the sort of canonical taste, the Fab Four of salt, mm-hmm. sour, sweet, and bitter. But I talk about umami right after that as this second candidate. And there are certain reasons why umami might not quite qualify. People would disagree with me on this. Other people want to say, yes, it's just as mm-hmm. just as real a taste as salty or sour. But in any event, without getting into that argument, what's really interesting about umami is it does have that quality of that feedback after the fact of swallowing. So, for example, there was a study that was done where eating a small amount of a very bizarre soup that was flavored with umami and then having the ingestive effects of that happen, people liked that soup much more than if they just tasted that soup without eating enough to have it interact mm-hmm. with their body, or if there was not this sort of umami quality about it. So this bizarre soup was made better because of the fact that the umami receptors in the gut interacted with the umami that was swallowed and then made the flavor of the actual soup more positive. And that's because umami tends to be a signal for protein.
So it's in people adherence, I guess. Think of this as a more full body experience than something which is simply or lacks umami.
Right, right. So umami, though, does give actual mouth sensation. So it does give kind of a fuller, it has actually a mouth feel. You can actually sort of feel umami. Some people don't like that actual feeling. It gives a sort of a more depth to food. That was how it was first introduced into American culture, was through Chinese restaurants and Chinese restaurants using monosodium glutamate, which is the basic sort of cooking form of umami. And because it actually, it provides salt, but it also kind of provides more depth to the food taste. But then there was sort of this backlash of people supposedly feeling sick after they had experienced, you know, too much Chinese food, which then turns out probably to have been just because they had too much Chinese food, right, and also probably too much salt, because the effects of having a very, very salty dinner can also have sort of negative consequences on how you immediately feel. But a little amount of umami can actually make not only the food itself taste better, but your sort of after effects of the food more positive.
So are there certain foods which are sort of quintessential examples of umami or providing umami?
Yes. So mushrooms have a great deal of umami in them. And that's one of the reasons why if you're a vegetarian, you go to a typical non-vegetarian restaurant and you want to know what the vegetarian option is, most likely it's something to do with the portobello mushrooms. And not because portobello mushrooms have any protein in them, but because the umami flavor of them, and also because they're sort of thick and you can cut them up with a knife and a fork, but the umami flavor of them is what gives them the sort of this proteinaceous quality. And people can kind of be tricked into feeling like they're having more of a meal because of the high umami quality. Another is tomatoes, and bread also has a lot of umami in it, as well as wine, and there's sort of other foods as well. But if you want to think about it in some ways, sort of the Mediterranean diet is sort of high in umami.
Why does I can eat an entire packet of seaweed, dried seaweed, and it tastes quite salty, but when I look at the ingredients or whatever, the nutritional value, it has very low sodium levels. Why does it taste salty but not apparently have much sodium in it?
So that's another perfect example of umami. So umami, there's, you know, seaweed is umami completely, you know, it's total umami. And one of the reasons why you're tasting it as being so salty is because umami is salty. And one of the problems of, let's say, considering it a pure basic taste is because people often confuse it with salt when they're given two samples and, you know, what is this, what is that? So unlike, for instance, nobody confuses salt with sour or with bitter or with sweet, but umami, people do confuse between salt. So it being purely distinctive, that's one of the problems for it being a pure basic taste.
So we have a couple callers who've been writing to us, and one of them is Bob from Rego Park, who called him to say that he's been vegan for 40 years and he wonders if eating meat is a kind of addiction.
Well, that's a really good question. Now, one of the things that I think is that anything that we do a lot of can become an addiction, whether it's email or eating donuts or meat or whatever the case might be. But I don't really adhere to the belief that eating falls into the addictions sphere the way people talk about drug abuse or alcohol abuse, even though eating does turn on the parts of the brain where reward and pleasure are activated. I feel like we have a different level of control over that desire than, for instance, when our bodies become addicted and need the substance. Otherwise, they fall into a depleted state, which is actually painful. So, for instance, a drug addict who doesn't have their cocaine, actually, their body basically crashes on them, and it's extremely unpleasant and extremely, you know, painful to exist. If you were a meat eater and you suddenly went off meat, you would not fall into that kind of a state. It might be, you know, you might be saying, I'd like to have some meat. But the interesting thing is that when we change our diet in any way, and salt is actually another really good example of this, if you put yourself on a salt diet because someone's told you consume too much salt, initially you'll find it hard to, you know, eat less salt. But after only a couple of months, you will have totally changed how much salt you actually like to taste. So that if then someone gave you, let's say, a slice of pizza with your normal amount of salt that you would have shaken on it in the past, you're going to find that aversively salty. So I think with our experiences with food, we change it and we respond to it through our own experience. It's not really, it's physiological, but it's physiological mediated by psychology and our experience with it.
I'm Arun Vanikopal, and I'm speaking with neuroscientist Rachel Herz about her latest book, Why You Eat What You Eat, the science behind our relationship with food. All right, you've touched on bacon a number of times. You have, I guess, some theory as to why bacon seems to be, there's a bacon obsession in our country, which is almost, I guess, you can't compare it to any other country as far as how crazy we are about bacon. Do you have an understanding? Why do we obsess so much about bacon nowadays?
Well, like I said, I think it has to do with our food television sort of telling us what it is. But there's also, I mean, bacon is, I would say, in my personal opinion, a really good smell, really good aroma. And that's because one of the things that's going on with the preparation of bacon. So bacon, if you just take it out of the refrigerator, raw bacon, you know, it's okay. But it's nothing like the smell of cooking bacon on a grill. And that's because what happens during the cooking process is something called the Maillard reaction, which is the transformation of proteins and amino acids into proteins and so on that takes place during cooking. And that actually is the same kind of thing that happens when we sear other protein, carbohydrate kinds of things, like even if you're searing the top of a creme brulee, mm-hmm. so something, you know, quote unquote, I know it has eggs, so not vegan, but more on the vegetarian, doesn't have to be meat. It creates these really full complex aromas that we have come to associate with really good tasting food. And so I think in our culture also, again, like I mentioned about smell, what we love in terms of smell is due to our experiences with it and also cultural associations. And so the more the culture says love bacon, the more we do love bacon, unless we have a personal aversion to it for whatever reasons we personally do.
Bacon has a lot of salt in it. You do discuss how much sometimes we crave salt versus the recommended guidelines. Do you think that we can stand to have more salt than what we're told by, is it the FDA?
Yeah, so I think, so if you look at research about salt, actually, you know, the recommendation of no salt, I don't think is actually good, because most studies in fact show, and this is the principle that you've probably heard about everything, you know, moderation is key. Mm-hmm. So really the Goldilocks principle, people who have the sort of medium amount of salt in their diet actually are the healthiest and live the longest. People who have no salt or very, very low salt in their diet, relatively speaking, and more along the lines of what the FDA would recommend, actually are less healthy than the medium consumers, and then the super consumers are also less healthy.
But this is culturally defined, right? I mean, say with meat, what is a medium amount of meat? It depends, America versus, I guess, India. That would be a dramatically different kind of thing. Is there any conclusive evidence on, say, meat and how much is okay, or are we actually meant to be meat eaters?
So that's a good question. I mean, we're meant to be omnivores. We're not meant to just, I mean, physiologically speaking, we're not meant to just eat plants, because it's very hard to get all the macronutrients we need from just plants. Not that you can't do it. I mean, being a vegan is totally possible and healthy, takes a lot of work and effort. And so from the point of view of just sort of, again, going back to sort of an evolutionary ancestral landscape where getting the macronutrients to survive was difficult, if you were just focusing on plants, that would be, it would be a lot harder to survive. So digestively, also just the way our bodies work in terms of breaking food down, we're not meant to only eat meat, because I've probably heard of something called rabbit starvation, mm-hmm. where people who, let's say, are in the wild eating just lean meat, they actually starve to death because their body starts breaking down because they don't have any carbohydrate in their system. So we can't just eat meat like the cats can, the people, you know, we can't eat just vegetables. Well, we can, but I mean, it's hard to do, and we have to moderate it with things like, so if you're just eating meat, you have to bring in fat. So you have to bring in some other form of calorie to help your body process the meat. You can't just have meat alone. And with vegetables, we have to be very sort of careful about what we're eating and making sure we're getting things like nuts and soy and other sorts of things like that to make sure that we're getting the protein that we need to do. So we're meant to be omnivores. But your question about what is medium, you know, I really can't answer that. And again, I think the guidelines are constantly changing. So, mm-hmm. you know, even everything that you look at in medicine, what is a proper, I think it's a blood pressure now, they've changed the guidelines right. very recently to what was sort of, before it was fine, I think 120 over 80, now they're saying that it should be a little less than that. And I think especially the lower number should be a little less than that. I can't remember exactly. But in any case, I've just seen that that's decreased. And same thing
with fat.
Yeah.
I mean, fat was at some point, I guess, considered just this terrible thing. But am I right in understanding that that was partly the work of the sugar lobby?
Right. So there's been, yes. So, I mean, the thing that I want to caution against is any kind of in-the-moment nutritional or medical advice should really be taken with a grain of salt, mm-hmm. no pun intended. And so, you know, the idea, again, of just being sort of careful, thoughtful about what you're consuming. Everyone knows when they've eaten too much of something. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist or some doctor to tell you, you know, really that 20th donut was probably not a good idea. So really sort of using common sense in terms of moderating what you're consuming. And also, again, understanding all the things that go into why you're choosing to eat that or why you're experiencing it in a certain way. And even the post-ingestive consequences, like thinking that something has a ton of calories, you actually burn more calories consuming than eating that exact same thing and thinking that it's low calorie.
Tell us about super tasters. What does it mean to be a super taster?
So that's a genetic characteristic, so it doesn't have anything to do with anything other than what you're born with.
Heroic quality.
Right. Although, like I was saying before, there is this kind of connection between being a non-taster and certain personality traits. There's also the personality traits of super tasters tend to be more sensitive. They're more sensitive to pain. They're sort of more, you know, thin-skinned in a sense. But so there are some psychological corollaries to these sorts of things, but it's a basic genetic trait that has to do with the allele that you have on a certain chromosome, and that will determine whether or not you are a taster, a non-taster, or a super taster. Tasters are in between. They have one version of each allele. And so what it means to be a super taster is that you have more taste buds on your tongue than people who are, let's say, non-tasters. So if you were to look at your tongue in the mirror and see all those little tiny dots, if you're a super taster, you would have a lot of them. And it's easier to see it if your tongue's been dyed a certain way. Also, if you want to know whether or not you're a super taster, besides putting some PTC paper in your mouth, which you might have done in high school, you can ask yourself, do I like endive? How much do I love Brussels sprouts and other sorts of things? And if you hate those foods, you're probably a super taster.
Is it, broadly speaking, a good thing to be a super taster, that you're going to enjoy life and food at least more?
Well, that's also an interesting question. So a lot of chefs actually are super tasters, but I've encountered some, in particular Wiley Dufresne, who has a famous restaurant in New York City, who is a non-taster, and he feels that being a non-taster is actually an advantage because he can sort of experience food in a different way and maybe know what other people who are not super tasters might prefer in terms of their levels of food preferences. But super tasters in the chef, in the high echelons of chefdom, there are more super tasters than otherwise. But the downside of being a super taster is, like I said, you find bitter to be really problematic. And therefore, you avoid the bitter leafy greens, which are actually very healthy and also can be preventative for certain kinds of cancers if you eat them in good quantity. And if you're totally avoiding them, then you actually have a higher risk of developing certain kinds of cancers. And that's actually been shown that super tasters do have higher incidence of different kinds of cancers because of the fact that they don't eat foods which are protective and antioxidant.
Even if we are not addicted to food, can cravings that we have, can that lead us to unusual behaviors?
Define unusual behaviors.
Well, I guess it's a subjective thing, but extreme or, I suppose, socially proscribed behaviors.
So, like,
when we divert from our day-to-day sort of, I guess, food inclinations, is that something that suggests that our chemistry is in some way imbalanced, or that we should, like, is it a warning sign, a red flag for people around them?
Yeah, so that's a good point. So there are cases where people are deprived of a certain kind of macronutrient. Let's say you can be deprived of salt, for instance. And we do really need salt. And in fact, so it's important to get a certain amount of salt in our diet. And so potentially craving salt, having to do with the fact that you're in a depleted state of salt, or craving calcium because you're in a depleted state of calcium, those are things where the wisdom of the body is kind of directing you because you need something to maintain a proper homeostatic balance of your physical system. But there's other cases where the craving is more psychological. And I think especially in today's world where we're very unlikely to be physiologically deprived unless something serious has happened to us, then we're more on the lines of a psychological craving. And then it's the important thing is to understand, why is it that I'm eating this? Is it because I'm lonely? Is it because I've just had a fight with someone? Is this a comfort food go-to that I'm wanting to experience at the moment? So why is it that I want to eat this? And again, understanding the why you eat what you eat can help you figure out what you're eating, and then maybe rein yourself in.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and I've been speaking with neuroscientist Rachel Herz about her latest book, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Arun.
Up next, James and Carla Murray, who've been photographing New York City since the 1990s with their new book, Storefront 2, A History Preserved. And later on in the show, Sarah Zask reveals her own experiences as an American woman raising her kids in Berlin and having to adapt to some surprising cultural differences. You're listening to Midday on WNYC.